There is nothing softer and weaker than water, and yet there is nothing better for attacking hard and strong things. For this reason, there is no substitute for it. Lao Tzu. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy and go back and peruse our prior episodes, and to any regular returners, thank you all so much. As always, your support means a lot. And to anyone that celebrates, I hope you had a safe and happy Easter with your family. Thank you all for joining me. Please like, rate, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. It'll help help the channel grow. Would like to shout out YouTube. We did reach, I believe, 250 subscribers as of a couple of days ago, but we've actually held to that number. I'm always worried someone's going to unsubscribe, and that may happen, but I'm sure we'll get back up there again. But this week, we're going to be moving away from more general regional information and begin to focus on specific Neolithic sites and cultures between 6 and 4,000 BC, BCE, maybe a little bit before that, maybe a couple hundred years, either way. Some of these I've already kind of touched on, but I'm going to kind of go over them again just so people are up to date, and that way I don't necessarily have to go back and listen to those old episodes and find them. But as always, please remember that this is not the sum total of human lifestyles at this point in time in this part of the world. It does not include humans still living as mobile hunter-gatherers or as pastoralists or a mix of those. Though some people living these lifestyles may have had regular interactions or have been related to settled Neolithic groups. Remember in earlier episodes this season about the Neolithic cultures in the Middle East, there is some evidence and theories that these settled sites were, in some ways, involved in mutually beneficial relationships with extended family or kin groups who still lived a more mobile lifestyle. Though consanguinity may not have been required to partake in these kinds of relationships, but it probably would have helped. At the very least, some knowledge of the language of the people you're dealing with. But with all that out of the way, we need to outline who, when, and where. So at the start of our season, there are at least seven of what modern archaeological terminology describes as Neolithic cultures, or at least close to seven. There is always debate about that sort of thing. Some of it comes down to, is there enough difference between relatively close places to suggest they were occupied by different groups? Or are there enough similarities between villages a few dozen kilometers apart to suggest they're related? That's always one of those things. And also, some of these sites and cultures may not arise until, a couple hundred years into the season, but close enough. By and large, generally speaking, most people recognize around seven or so that are kind of happening during at least some point of this season. Now, a few weeks ago, we already discussed the abandonment of the Zhengpian Cave in about 5,500 BC by its inhabitants, which ends about a 1,500-year semi-regular occupation of the site, and the disappearance of at least a semi-Neolithic culture and a semi-sedentary culture in what is now the very far south of China for about 1,000 years. And probably, this is probably due to a number of things, environmental factors, an increasing reliance on agriculture for sustenance, and you need to get out of those more rocky inlands and kind of move to maybe some better, more fertile and watered lands along the Pearl River, things like that. Though, of course, there could be sites that haven't been found, between the period where the Zhengpian Caves are abandoned, and the emergence slash arrival of what is going to be called the Dapin Kung culture next season. But the Dapin Kung do not show up at the very least until about, I think it's 3,500 BC, you know, give or take a couple hundred years. So they're gonna be firmly in next season. The other culture that is winding down, or maybe already has, is the Peng To Shan culture. Now, I'm unsure of the name as this site. I know that there is a type site that is Peng To Shan, but I'm assuming it's a nickname kind of also of like a local regional hill or mountain. The character for Peng can be translated as drum, and To can be used for head, and Shan is mountains. So this is probably translatable as the Drumhead Mountain culture. Now, there are a few sites associated with it, and those are, Peng To Shan, Bai Shidong, Fin Shan Bao, Huang Jiajuan, and Tuji Ji Tai, as well as a couple of others, you know, that are kind of mentioned. But all of these are relatively small, but they are permanent villages. I think the largest is Bai Shidong, and it was around 7.5 acres, which is like 3 hectares, give or take. And it is also, I believe, the longest lasting of these sites. It is probably the last site associated with Bashidong culture, or not Bashidong, but Peng To Shan culture. And it is noticeable for a number of reasons, including the fact that these have what are considered to be the oldest walls and ditches in China, which, you know, if you know anything about Chinese culture later, they create incredibly high walled cities, and they're very good about fortifying them or giving extra protection to those cities with things like walls and ditch, or with ditches and, you know, dikes and things like that. So, you know, this is a, you know, very, very, you know, kind of universal thing in the area. But this is kind of the first site that, at least in China, that we found so far that kind of exhibits something that will become kind of ubiquitous in some cases with like early Chinese city planning. Although, again, not a city in terms of size or, you know, population. Now, the Peng To Shan were, in addition to hunting, gathering, and fishing, they were also involved in early rice agriculture. They're far south, that they're not kind of in the millet zone, though I do think there is some evidence that they also had millet, though I don't think it was a large amount. But they mainly have kind of focused more on more aquatic crops that needed a lot more water, I guess. But they do appear to have domestic rice or domesticated rice. Kind of in the middle part of their period, you begin to see what is, you know, a lot larger grains of rice, closer to like modern day domestic rice size, and much larger than what you would see in wild rice. So they are involved in that. They also grow like water caltrops and other kind of semi-aquatic leafy greens. There's also evidence that they were attempting to domesticate soybeans. These are like the oldest evidence of soybean growth in China until like the Bronze Age. No other culture, at least from one site that I saw. Though, you know, this could have changed, and that could have just been like an old article. But as far as I could tell, that this is the first place in China that soybean domestication was attempted. Though it doesn't appear that it was successful. That being said, you know, their sites were kind of dotted along the Li Shui River, and that is part of the Yangtze River system. And I think it's like the Liyuan Plain. The closest largest modern day city in China that these would be neighbors to is the city of Chengde. Though I think most of the Pengtouchan sites were a little further west and north than Chengdu is, so they're a little closer to the mountains, hence, the name of Pengtouchan. Though there are also like a number of lakes and things like that. So, a lot of different or a lot of variety fairly close to the region in terms of environment and terrain. Now, they also, of course, made pottery, which, I think the oldest examples again of pottery have been in Asia for quite a while. But, they had very fine ware, very finely made pottery, very smooth, not a lot of kind of coarse grains, very well put together stuff. Now, they didn't paint it, and it appears mostly, I believe, to have been either kind of a brown or a dark red in some cases. And while they weren't painting it, they were using different kinds of cords and knots to kind of impress patterns on the pottery. And these, of course, changed over time, and there's a little bit of variation between the sites, things like that. They also were making a large variety of different shape pottery. They kind of had these larger kind of cauldron shape potbelly, or potbelly, that's redundant, but kind of these wider brimmed pots that were fairly large. They had some with legs that they would use to stand. They also had some that they would use to store grain for extended periods. Their architecture, pretty varied. They had both subterranean buildings and also buildings that were just built, above ground with a foundation. They did communal burials, and they also buried individuals with grave goods. Not a lot of them. They typically individuals were buried with between like one and four items. Probably something to do with, what they did in life. Food was occasionally buried as well. So, it appears though that it's, fairly universal. There's no apparent social distinction in these burials. No one has anything that's, super more ostentatious from any of their other neighbors. Now, in terms of animals, there is, some debate, but most people think kind of towards the end there, they were definitely kind of mixing it up instead of wild animal protein that they're using, or not just using, I guess, but using some domesticated animals as well, possibly pigs, which could have been domesticated by this point later in their history. But again, some of that's debated, and it's really hard to tell, early domesticated animals from wild animals, because they're still, relatively similar in terms of size and physiology. But of course, by about 5800 BC, the sites of the Pengtouchan are more or less abandoned, or they're abandoned for a few years, and then maybe someone's come back. But it appears that there is kind of a shift in the like these traditions and similarities between pottery and stuff like that falls apart. Oh, in addition to one thing I did forget to mention, in addition to using Neolithic tools, they are still using larger stone and bone tools for things like spades or digging utensils. So they're not completely Neolithic, but they're pretty damn close for to becoming like a full-on getting rid of all their I guess you call it Paleolithic tools. But again, for the type of things that they continue to use larger stones for, it's actually probably pretty useful. Though, of course, again, with things like bone, you're worried about it breaking or chipping, things like that. Now, a lot of the Pengtouchan sites are abandoned earlier than Bashidang, which, again, the latest that people kind of date Bashidang to is about 5800 BC. So it's kind of the last holdout of the Pangtoshan sites. Now, after that, there is a break between them and the next Neolithic culture to kind of, you know, arise along the Middle Yangtze River. And the next culture, I'm going to go ahead and cover them next just because they're neighbors and this is the same general area. This is known as the Daxi culture. Now, the Daxi culture is a little bit further to the west. And they had a bigger footprint than the Pangtoshan culture. They are in what is now called the Three Gorges region of China. And they essentially kind of occupied numerous sites along a couple of the larger tributaries coming down from the Tibetan Plateau and, you know, two of the big rivers that go in to form the Yangtze. But again, they're a little bit more in the mountains and they're kind of occupying these river valleys. And they're a very long-lasting culture. They appear in the archaeological record. I think their oldest sites are right around 5,000 BC. And then as time goes on, you see them move a little bit further east into what was Pangtoshan culture area. And they go further south, too. So they have a very kind of a, almost like a, almost circular kind of territory if you look at it on a map. But they have advancements in pottery, at least in terms of coloring. They have white pottery, black pottery, and then they also begin to paint the pottery in red, especially the black pottery is usually painted red. They also have individual vessels, I guess you'd call pottery, instead of like these larger kind of communal ones. They have these very thin bowls and goblets. I think in Chinese they're referred to as dou, D-O-U, is how you would write it in with the Roman or the Latin alphabet. And they're kind of cylindrical shaped. But of course they do keep the, you know, the larger bowls too. They also have these kind of serving stands and tripods too. And this is going to be a very long-lasting culture. They will continue until next season. Now, it's kind of hard to nail down exactly when they begin to move a little bit further east. I would not imagine until kind of towards about 4,000 BC or so. And that's a rough guess on my part. I can't say for sure. I wasn't able to really get good data on those Western sites, but we know they're there. And there is, or not Western sites, Eastern sites. I've said West. It's to the east. Back to the Pangtoshan region. But it is believed that they do have some trade links with groups further up the Yangtze, towards the going towards the coast. Part of the reason that that is believed is because of jade artifacts. You know, there's evidence that you know, the cultures along, you know, along the Yangtze Delta are actively mining and finding and using jade artifacts. So there's probably a good bit of trade between those regions. Though there are sources of jade to the west too. So it's possible that they had their own homegrown sources, but you know, for whatever reason, a lot of archaeologists in China believe that those are coming from the Yangtze. And I think that's due to designs and things like that. And those are not designs that are associated with the Daxi. Though these links probably wouldn't last too long. Like I said, the Daxi lasts till about 3,300. So they'll continue on for a little while. the culture that's most associated with the jade artifacts that they're getting, they last until about 3,000. And there's a couple of those that we'll talk about this season. They'll be a little bit further down the line. Now, in terms of genetic evidence, they've actually found some and tested a couple of those remains found at Daishi sites. And the Y DNA, the male DNA, essentially, does not line up with what you would consider Chinese male lineages. These are groups more associated with the Hmong speakers or the Miao languages. So it's thought that eventually that they'll begin to move to the southwest. So this isn't kind of in the running for the Han culture or the, you know, what will eventually become Han Chinese culture. This is kind of considered a neighbor to those cultures. The Daishi are also, in addition to their vessels, they're also making just regular plates, you know, very thin, flat pieces of ceramic or pottery, not necessarily ceramic. They also, like the Pengtou Shan, are creating fortifications, or not necessarily fortifications, but they are using walls and ditches for their sites, which some people link to the Pengtou Shan. They think these groups might be related, though I didn't see any mention specifically of Pengtou Shan DNA. I don't know if they found any like traceable sources of DNA at Pengtou Shan sites. If they are, that's not in English, at least not that I've read. So just bear that in mind. Also, it's important to remember that, you know, archaeologists like to point out, you know, you don't necessarily need walls to defend yourself from other people. They could be used for a type of animal control or, you know, your own internal population control. But, you know, there's also the possibility that, yes, they were defensive fortifications from neighboring groups, maybe even neighboring Daiji groups. There's no guarantee that these different sites were always at peace with one another. Of course, you know, there's also the possibility that, you know, hunter-gatherers in the area or pastoralists were, you know, raiding their agricultural sites. And these are all permanent settlements. The Daishi, they are fully agriculturalist. I'm sure that they supplemented, you know, their diet with wild animals and hunted animals and, you know, domesticated animals, but their primary, you know, calorie intake was from grown food. So that's a change over from the Pengtou Shan. The Pengtou Shan, they were practicing agriculture, but that was only a part. I think the estimates I saw that the Pengtou Shan, their diet was never made up of more than like 50% domesticated versus wild sources. And that, you know, that wouldn't surprise me considering there's a lot more Daishi sites than there are Pengtou Shan sites. But we will return to Daishi next season. They are succeeded by a culture who, you know, there's a pretty good evidence, and I think most of the theories kind of hold that the culture that follows them up is closely related to the Daiji people, or whoever the Daiji people were. But that's all again for next season. And I think this is kind of a good place to call it. It is fairly late for me. I was late getting back today with travel for Easter. So we're going to go ahead and call it here. I think next week we're going to talk about the cultures who were probably interacting with the Daishi along the lower Yangtze River, kind of around the Delta region. And there's going to be, I think, four cultures that kind of occupy that general area. There is no cultures kind of upriver from the Daishi, at least that's Neolithic. Obviously, there are probably, you know, numerous hunter-gatherers still living in the foothills and the mountains and what's, you know, the Tibetan Plateau. But that the Neolithic doesn't show up there, you know, until much later. I don't even know if there's like a Neolithic or like a agricultural-based culture, even what we'll talk about next season. Though I could be wrong about that. I need to double check the time frame for that area. But you know, we got a few of those cultures out of the way, and then we'll, you know, we'll kind of see how seven will become 11 cultures in fairly quick succession along the Yangtze, the lower Yangtze River. And then after that, we'll kind of move to the Yellow River cultures, and that one, that might be another two-parter. We'll have to see. And then we'll have a part for some of the other kind of peripheral agricultural Neolithic sites in other parts of what is now China. So this is actually going to be, you know, a fairly long section, longer than I initially thought. But again, just bear that in mind. I'm going to try to have this out at the regular time. I should get the audio podcast up at regular intervals from like the RSS feed. The YouTube might be a little bit delayed. I'm not sure yet, but we'll just have to wait and see. And speaking of timing, I am thinking about maybe pushing the live time back a little. I got advice from another podcaster. He recommended to me that sometimes it's best to let your podcast just sit and wait to be published before the algorithm picks it up. You know, sometimes if you let it sit a couple of extra hours, whatever site uses the, whatever algorithm the sites use to kind of push things out to people, like discovery and things like that, sometimes it's best to let it sit and let the system kind of sort through like your tags and your things like that. So, I might start pushing the go live time back a couple of hours, but, I publish at my time. It's like 1 a.m. I think is when it publishes for me. I might push it back to kind of later morning period, but that's something I'm debating. I might test that out a little bit for a week or two and see if it gets the numbers up even more. Yeah, so that's something I'm kind of looking into. But I do thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you've enjoyed. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please feel free to let me know. You can reach out to me at my email, war@revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X. You can comment on the YouTube videos. I may not see those immediately, but you know, I do try to read comments as best I can. You can also, I should live stream on YouTube most of the week. You know, I'm always happy to have people stop in, say hey. And yeah, thank you all for joining me. I hope you've had a pleasant listening experience, and I hope that you will join me next time. And until I see you next time, I hope you have a good rest of your day and or week from whenever you're listening to this. Peace.